written October 2019. The Empire Strikes Back or A New Hope? As Britain's disastrous Brexit experiment drags on, the rest of Europe looks on despairingly, but with no shortage of problems of their own.
Poland's ruling Nationalist Party has declared victory in the country's parliamentary election. The Populist Law and Justice Party will win over 40% of the vote. An overall majority in Parliament would allow the party to continue its controversial reforms of the justice system.
So maybe we're all in need of a bit of hope. Welcome to this episode of the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper from the LSE, and my co-host Zoe Williams from The Guardian. The pod was recorded at our podcast and party event in London with guests Kojo Karam and Anna Oppenheim. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome everyone, welcome guests. Kojo Karam is lecturer at Birkbeck with a new book out, The War on Drugs and the Global Colour Line. He's also written about the colonial fantasies of Brexit, especially in terms of the great trading nation illusion. Anna Oppenheim is a campaigner with Another Europe is Possible, and when she's not busy with that, a Polish anti-fascist.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And
thank
the title
you.
Of this discussion is October 2019, The Empire Strikes Back or A New Hope. So I don't know whether you guys are going to give us loads of hope or just going to say that the Empire is really struck back.
Don't look for me for hope.
Really painfully hurting us deeply in its latest reincarnation. But maybe we could start off on the theme of Empire and direct this to you, Kojo. You wrote a really good piece a little while ago now for The Guardian, looking at this idea that Brexit is full of this great nation, trading nation mythology, and how that comes from a colonial memory. But you also just pointed out very practically that this was like a really impractical set of policies to be pursuing in the world in the 21st century. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of combination, because lots of post-colonial thinking can somehow operate at quite an abstract level, but you really brought it down to earth. And I think that would be a good place for us to kick off.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Luke. Thank you, everyone, for joining us and for inviting me onto this podcast. In terms of providing hope, I think the only hope that I'm clinging on to is the hope that somehow this whole sorry episode will be over someday soon, because I
he's
think
referring
that,
to the episode of Brexit,
of course,
rather
yeah.
than this specific
not
episode
this episode of the podcast. No, that's fine. I hope this never leaves. I hope this never stops. Because, as you mentioned, Luke, I think that when we talk about the rhetoric that has driven Brexit, and particularly the rhetoric that appeared to drive the desire for a no-deal Brexit that was being pushed by a particular section of the Tory right, you know, your ERGs, your now referred to as the Spartan Tory right, I think that we are talking about a idea of Britain's place in the world and Britain's relationship with the international legal institutions that relies upon this colonial fantasy that you mentioned. Not only a fantasy, but particularly a certain amnesia. A certain amnesia that allows for the proponents of Brexit to try and draw a line between their imagining of when Britain did have control, when it was this great trading nation, you know, sometime around the 1846 Corn Laws, and sometimes around the idea where Britain really solidified its self-conception as a trading nation, and they try and draw a line connecting that to what Britain could be if it left the European Union again, but completely ignoring the wider context for Britain's supremacy within the middle to late 19th century, which is, of course, the context of empire. So that erasure of empire, I think, is really at the heart of why we can understand certain sections of the population of Britain being tempted to exit the EU on WTO rules. You know, the idea of, well, we can just go it alone and we'll be able to survive on our own doesn't make sense to anybody around the world, because the countries that have had to operate on WTO rules have been trying to leave. You know, everyone's going this way and a certain section of the British population is trying to drive us in the opposite direction. And I think that that again shows a particular misunderstanding of the global economic and legal and political framework that relies upon the persistence of kind of colonial fantasy.
And do you get the impression that they genuinely don't know, or that they're utilizing a kind of pretend ignorance in the service of a political agenda.
So in terms of the very expensively educated members of the ERG or Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, I think that, of course, they are aware of the context through which Britain managed to achieve its economic supremacy in the 19th century. But they're also aware of the way in which the international legal framework over the latter half of the 20th century solidified into a structure which protected capital as it was traded around the world and opened up markets. And these are the kind of dual mandates at the core of the WTO. As it transitioned from the GATT to the WTO, you get a real institutionalization of the protection of multinational capital against the threat of popular democracy. And I think that they are aware of the certain economic benefits that will accrue to a certain percentage of the population with a no-deal Brexit. But being able to use their understanding of that tied to the kind of, self-mythology of Britain as always being an island nation, as always being a great trading nation, as always being an underdog nation, I think makes it a particularly potent argument and one that's unfortunately been quite successful.
So in a sense, are we kind of tugging at the wrong string because we're fretting publicly about their ignorance? But really, they're not ignorant at all. They're just pursuing a political agenda other than the one they declare.
I think the coalition that's been put together to drive the support of Brexit includes people from both camps. You know, I think that the investment capitalist class, people like Tim Martin, the owner of Wetherspoons, or James Dyson, and all those who salivate at the prospect of a Singapore-style tax haven Britain following Brexit, have an understanding of the potential wealth that can be accrued in that kind of context because they've seen it happen elsewhere. But there's also a driving support from Brexit from a different section of the population that I think are being more seduced by the mythology of Britain, and that is tied closer to ignorance. And so I think there's both working together.
Yeah.
And I suppose in this car crash Brexit that they want, in a way, it doesn't really matter that it's impractical to only trade on WTO terms, because in practice, they don't really like WTO terms. What they want to use the car crash for is a moment of crisis to sign as many possible trading agreements with other states, and probably also to not be too concerned by the institution of a border on the north of Ireland in the process. So, you know, you'd use the chaos to both strike a Canada-style agreement with the European Union. Oh, we've got to get end the chaos. We need a baseline free trade agreement that doesn't protect much, which is very similar to the one that is actually Boris has negotiated for most of the UK. It's a very deregulatory Brexit. And then also in the chaos, you would sign deals, as many as you can, with Trump's America. The State Department offered Britain, Brexit Britain, a trade agreement in 9 months. And the kind of agreement you would get in 9 months from someone who believes that every trade agreement that the United States has ever signed has been a conspiracy against the United States is going to be quite a rough deal for British workers, I guess.
I mean, I definitely agree with that. And you can already start to see that drive towards deregulation, that drive towards the bonfire of workers' protection and environmental protections within the trajectory that Brexit is going in. And I think that the chaos offers an opportunity for that. You know, it's very much the story that kind of Naomi Klein talked about in terms of the shock doctrine, but moving it from the arena of Latin America and the global south, but to the former heart of empire itself. I think that we can't underestimate the kind of consistent hostility towards the European social democratic model that was, in the eyes of a certain section of the Tory right, imposed upon Britain in the post-war era. And there is a real chronology going all the way from Anthony Fisher and the establishment of the Institute of Economic Affairs and the Bruges Group and, you know, all these think tanks that have been waiting for an opportunity to unpick, in fact, that social democratic welfare model. And I think that, yeah, Brexit is seen as their opportunity.
And Thatcher's obsession with Victorian values as well, always hammering away the values I stand for are Victorian, without observing, apparently, that this was an era when Britain wasn't a democracy. You know, like, this is a big problem. Anna, let's bring you in.
Hello.
And welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show. So Brexit is often conceived in the minds of everyone here, and also I think in the minds of a lot of the public, as like uniquely bad like a uniquely bad crisis. But I suppose on this show, we always try to look at it in the broader international context as much as possible. And I guess from a Polish perspective, you might not see it as uniquely bad, given that Poland also has a pretty unpleasant, pretty hard right government that's at the center of this stuff in Europe. And you've recently had the elections, which the far right party won, Law and Justice, but there were also some quite promising, like Resistance, there's a new left party that's emerging. So there's these opportunities as well. But I just wonder how much of the kind of memory politics that Kojo was talking about, I mean, that's been a big part of the Polish debate, right? This idea of Polish nationalism.
Yeah, it absolutely has. It came as no surprise to anyone that the Law and Justice government got re-elected. It's been known for a while. The ratings are unfortunately extremely good. That is a government that is immensely dangerous, that's attacked basic democratic principles, that's taken over public media completely, that's undermined the justice system, that's also run high-profile racist campaigns about refugees being a threat to the West, or currently is in the middle of a homophobic campaign, directing everyone's attention towards the so-called LGBT ideology that's threatening the West, Europe, and the future of our children and our nation. That's very much a narrative that the government is putting forward. And history and the use of history has played a huge part in this. So on a daily basis in Poland, we have debates that are seemingly about interpretations of history and national memory, but really deep inside, they are about visions of Poland, of the present and of the future. So, for example, we debate street names all the time and whether a street should be named after this or that historical figure or this or that historical event, obviously very charged and usually linked to things that are happening currently. Equally, national holidays, what days should be celebrated. These things are always in the news. We had the controversial National Remembrance Law that criminalized any mention of Polish involvement in the Holocaust, even when it was just discussion of historical facts, which is a battle of a kind of vision of Poland as this of a great, perfect nation that other nations can be only seen as a threat to. And it also has a kind of subcultural aspect. So, for example, a lot of proper far-right groups, which is the right of the government, will use historical reenactment as an excuse to push very dangerous, marginal far-right ideas. So, for example, there is a popular fashion brand that even our president wears that produces t-shirts that say things like death to the traitors of the homeland. And they will say it's a Second World War reference, but we know in the current context, it's also a dog whistle. And that means refugees, migrants, LGBT people, left-wing people like myself. So that is a way of sneaking in very dangerous content, presenting it as history. And equally, the November 11 March, the biggest far-right march in Europe, is celebrated as Independence Day. So a lot of people will look at it and say, no, it's just a national holiday. But when you look at the banners, they're quite obviously racist. So it's gone much further, I think, than anything we've seen in Britain so far. But at the same time, when we get some of the emails to our Europe office talking about Brexit, but suddenly mentioning the Empire and the Second World War, I can see some parallels emerging.
It sort of surprises me that Poland would have the kind of national insecurities. Like in Britain, I get the national neurosis. Huge imperial empire gone. National neurosis is, oh God, what's happened? What's our place in the world? It all kind of makes sense. Whereas in Poland, of course, all of the stuff Law and Justice say about there's no responsibility or culpability for the Holocaust is disgraceful and awful. But there is genuinely a proud anti-fascist history that they could take. They had a huge resistance movement to the Nazis, probably bigger than the French one that everyone talks about. They had Solidarnosc. There's actually quite a lot of positive things that you can talk about in Polish history. So why would people get so schizophrenic about it and say you have to interpret it in all of these crazy ways?
A lot of this goes quite deeply in history. I mean, we're talking about a nation that for over a century was under occupation, that did not have its own country and the right to have its own state. And therefore, the idea of national identity as something that has to be protected and fought for is quite deeply ingrained in our culture, in our kind of collective psyche. And there is this mythology of Poland as kind of the most oppressed nation, that we've been attacked from so many sides in so many different ways. And that is the kind of narrative that's kind of very, popular in our education system, in our culture as well, cinema and so on. And the government has quite successfully weaponized it. But yes, I agree, events such as the anti-fascist resistance or more recently Solidarność are events that pretty much anyone across the political scene agrees are something to be proud of. But their interpretations, once again, are very different. Because they were broad movements, in the Second World War, there were coalitions of people who saw themselves as primary nationalists and people who saw themselves as primary anti-fascists. And equally, Solidarność had anything from socialists to quite conservative, traditional nationalist Catholics. So it is quite true that however you want to use history, people interpret these events in a different way. And the left is slowly trying to kind of create its own narrative about Poland and about, you know, where we came from, where we're going.
Kojo, you've written a book about the war on drugs. Now, that seems quite only tangentially related to this kind of new nationalism or kind of ahistorical posturing. But there is a kind of moralizing element which does feed back into the ethno-nationalism.
I mean, yes, so there's that part, there's that moralizing religiosity that kind of underpins both of those phenomena. But there's also a more immediate connection, thinking about kind of Britain, the politics of memory and the contemporary moment and the kind of war on drugs. My PhD was looking at the history of international drug prohibition, and I really kind of came towards looking at the question of Britain, imperial amnesia and imperial memory when I was researching the memory of Britain's role in the Opium Wars in the middle of the 19th century. You know, as Luke mentioned a little bit earlier, there's so much celebration in the Tory right of kind of Victorian values, Victorian ideals, Victorian free marketeer trading. But one of the big things that was being traded around the world by Victorian Britain in the 19th century was, you know, opium. Like, Queen Victoria, unfortunately, was the biggest drug dealer of the 19th century. And that kind of, yeah, amnesia, that kind of forgetting, and realizing how that forgetting was written into the histories and the ideas of Britain's role in terms of the Opium Wars, how much less known that is than some of the domestic conflicts that solidify this idea of Britain as a kind of defensive island nation. You know, things like Dunkirk or Waterloo started to, yeah, put me on the kind of second research project of looking at Britain, empire, memory, and of course, how that feeds into the current Brexit moment.
What's the thesis of the book? Is the thesis of the book that there's a kind of codification of prohibition, that it kind of works with the existing politics, or that it actually undercuts the existing politics?
So the actual book itself was an editor collection. Mm-hmm. So after, yeah, definitely give respect and shout outs to my fellow co-authors. And the book was looking at the way in which the international laws on drugs, which are written in a kind of horizontal and neutral way, actually have reinforced and deepened racial and ethnic divisions across multiple jurisdictions. So I had authors from Colombia, South Africa, Canada, United Kingdom, all these different jurisdictions, looking at the way in which the policing and prohibition of drugs facilitates racial and ethnic divisions, whether that's in terms of imprisonment, in terms of enclosure, in terms of surveillance, a lot of different stuff. Didn't look at the United States because all the research in that topic is already on the United States. So we like consciously ignored America for the first time.
So to move us on to Britain, October 2019, we've had a quite tortuous, now twice delayed or set to be twice delayed, still slightly up in the air, attempt to leave the European Union. But we are all completely hanging in there by our fingertips, thankfully. Now, everyone seemed to be quite surprised that Johnson got a deal. I think if you'd been listening to the podcast, I don't think we were that surprised. Were we?
I was actually quite surprised.
Okay, all right. All right, I can't claim that for the podcast. But in a way, wasn't it always obvious that for the reasons that you were talking about earlier, I mean, no deal is just like a mad fantasy in a way. And because the European Union has always offered a Canada-style baseline free trade agreement, it would be foolish for the Brexiteers not at a certain point to take that and to cast Ireland aside. But I think that their willingness to cast Northern Ireland aside is quite, has opened up a quite interesting rupture in the 52%, because of course it essentially means that there's no longer a 52%, because everyone who voted for Brexit in Northern Ireland is no longer really, who tends to be a unionist, tends to be maybe a DUP supporter, is no longer supporting this particular type of Brexit. So I find it interesting the way that the empire thing through Ireland has completely come directly into the debate and into its conclusion, potentially.
Absolutely. When we talk about the kind of forgetting of the legacies of empire, nowhere is that more immediate than in the place that's across the Irish Sea. You know, we forget that a quarter of the United Kingdom has been engaged in persistent military conflict for the better part of the 20th century. And even if after the forgetting, in terms of the reminding, the lack of empathy, lack of care around that, I think has really, like you mentioned, marked a division within what was the traditional conservative movement within the United Kingdom. The idea of, yeah, the proximity between monarchy, unionism, and conservatism was seen as really solid. But we can see with Brexit, not only the sacrifice of Northern Ireland, but also the sacrifice of Scotland, which was barely mentioned in the withdrawal agreement. And so I think that polls have shown, I think it was a Lord Ashcroft poll, that a majority of Brexiteers are happy to both cast out both Northern Ireland and Scotland, essentially break up the union in order to achieve their idealized version of what Britain could be. And so that definitely should be a schism amongst the conservative movement for those people who, for who the union was, you know, sacred.
On that, there was that amazing poll of Conservative Party members, people who have joined a party where the membership card says Conservative and Unionist Party, that thought the breakup of the union was a price worth paying for delivering Brexit. I mean, I genuinely can't understand that, in the sense that how is, from a nationalist basis, that what this project is, it's like the first nationalism in history that has consciously set out to make its territorial borders smaller. I mean, it's like, what can you say to that? But Anna, fill us with hope from the Another Europe office. We're going to win, right?
That was an unfair curveball.
Obviously, I have to say yes, we're going to win. I mean, if there has been one thing that's been consistent in this process, is that nobody knows what's going on. It's actually been quite refreshing when I've seen people make very informed, detailed predictions, and all of them turn out to be wrong, and they're as valuable as a coin toss. So I'll say yes, we are going to win. That's the best way we can achieve anything, is by believing we are going to win. And no matter what comes next, keep fighting, because we know what we stand for. We know we are right. And we know the other side don't know what they're doing, so...
But that's what's interesting. You say that we were all surprised that Johnson got a deal and we shouldn't have been surprised, but a lot of that was the fact that there was a huge amount of information that they hadn't been to the EU, they hadn't offered anything, they hadn't agreed anything, they hadn't had any talks. Whoever had gone without any pieces of paper. This was like a deluge of quite concrete signs that no effort was being made to secure a deal, which must have been a collusion between...
It was a campaign of disinformation.
It was a campaign of disinformation on the part of the government, which was also reinforced and believed by their opponents and their EU counterparts. So we're dealing with something quite unusual, where the lines were being fed, we're kind of swallowing whole because they sort of make sense within a government that doesn't know what it's doing anyway. And I don't think we're wrong to be surprised that there was a deal. I think we're wrong to look uncritically at just how much disinformation we must have believed in order to have got to the place where we thought that.
Absolutely. So I think our audience will have views on this as well when we throw it out to them. But I mean, Johnson has basically offered the opposition a December election. So what do we think of that? On our September podcast, we did one with James Meadway, where, you know, we're sitting in the park recording it, and I think we were all convinced, or I don't know if Zoe was, the September election,
No, I said no. Okay. I said no, and now you're and you think that was the
totally
biggest mistake ever.
I was totally in favour of a September election, that podcast, let history say. So now there's a danger or opportunity, depending on what you think, of, like, the Labour not voting for a December election either. Strategic intelligence or historic failure?
I think we should embrace an election. I think there is nothing to wait for, really. The longer the Brexit process goes on, the more people are tired and the more we hear things like, let's just get the deal passed so that we can talk about other things and move on. Obviously, a deal passing would not mean moving on. It will mean many more years of debating our future relation with the EU, other trade deals. It will dominate the news. We'll fight over it forever. I don't want any of that. And I hope, well, nobody really wants it. But yeah, there is a risk of the deal passing. If we have an election, it's quite an exciting opportunity. I mean, obviously it's scary, but we have to believe in what we stand for. And as the left, we have a lot of exciting ideas to promote. We can talk about not just Brexit, but things like the Green New Deal, things like a shorter working week, radical ideas that people can genuinely feel inspired by, regardless of what they think about Brexit. And in terms of Brexit, I think we should be also quite unapologetic, talking about international solidarity, talking about migrant rights, because in a situation where we have the wave of kind of far-right reaction sweeping not just Europe, but the world, it is a historical responsibility as well for us to not let it happen, but stand and fight back.
What do you think, Koja?
I do think that there is a danger. By the longer this goes on, the longer there is a kind of delay around an attempt of using an election to kind of break the parliamentary deadlock, that the idea becomes more and more concrete in the minds of the general public that the reason for all the frustration around Brexit is somehow the Labour Party's fault. Yeah. I think this is an amazing kind of, skullduggery that's been pulled off by the Conservative Party, where you have a referendum promised by a Conservative Prime Minister, fought in terms of the Conservative Prime Minister, lost by a Conservative Prime Minister. The withdrawal deals are being failed by multiple Conservative Prime Ministers, but somehow, you know, every time you switch on question time, everyone's blaming the person who's representing the Labour Party for the failure of Brexit. And, you know, I think that if there is the extension granted by the EU and Johnson does look for the December the 12th election, I think it's difficult to not go for that without, again, solidifying that idea in the mind of the general public that Labour don't want things to go forward. They're somehow blocking it. You know, I think that, yeah, we want a Labour government. We want Labour to win a general election. And in order to be able to win a general election, you have to look like you're willing to want and you want to fight election. And so I think you want to be careful about appearing too hesitant around that, I think, myself.
And none of you are concerned about the Labour's polling position?
I mean, there's no way to a recovery in those polling numbers without the oxygen of an election campaign. The patient needs oxygen. The election campaign is a big canister of oxygen because it gives the patient all of the energy that Anna was talking about. The broadcasting rules means that Labour can get its message out there. It forces in the minds of a lot of the public that voted Labour in 2017, you have a really tough choice to make here because there are only two people that can become Prime Minister. And we know you don't like one of them, but you dislike the other one even more. And in most places in the country, that means that you have to tactically vote for the guy that you don't like that much, but isn't...
It's not very oxygenating, this idea.
Put on a slogan. I also think we shouldn't underestimate the challenge that the Tory party will face at a general election. Mm-hmm. That they have, you know, there's this idea that Boris Johnson is this great unifier and he's got these amazing poll numbers and everyone feels sympathy for him. And whilst he might have a successful personal brand of a certain type, I don't understand why, but he seems to, I think that they're facing real challenges. They're going to be taxed on the Remain side by the Liberal Democrats, who are going to be contesting, you know, all over the Southwest and will be able to solidify the Remain vote in those areas. They're going to be suffering pressure from the Brexit Party, it seems, who are talking about this deal being worse than Theresa May's, not supporting it, you know, asking now for an EU extension. You've got Farage asking to remain in the EU a little bit longer. Obviously, the DUP and that support is going to be completely hemorrhaged by this vote. So I think there's a lot of pressures on the Conservative Party for a general election. And I think with the position of the Scottish National Party, the Labour Party, there's a potential for a shift in government. What happens after that is probably the more scary question, if that does happen. Yeah, I think that the polling numbers are obviously concerning, but they're not a reason to present yourself as scared, I would say.
Also, Labour only need to make a net gain of like 10 seats. Watch the SNP take all of the Tories' seats, and then you can have a coalition government. But anyway,
then you get Independent Scotland, and then you've got the like Brexit times 10 for the next 10 years. I'm going to kill myself. Sorry.
That would be a blow to the podcast. Concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast has had a great start, but there's very much more to come. To keep it sustainable and to expand, we've introduced extra time for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's extra time, we discuss the relationship between crony capitalism and the new far right in Poland, and how exactly a referendum or election would put the demons of Brexit back in the box. To join the campaign and listen to the extra time, just go to anotheruropeorg/join. You can also feed back to us on our podcast content by emailing podcast@anotheruropeorg. We'll be back very soon. See you then.